Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 249 featuring Peter Ramsey, who I did a podcast with at THU. This is officially the first podcast that I recorded at THU 2019 and many more to come, which I'll be scattering around as the days go by or the weeks go by. He is an amazing person. Kristen, tell me, what are some of the amazing things that you heard in this podcast?
Well, the first thing, which is cool, he was born and raised in LA, which
In South Central.
Yeah, in South Central. You don't meet many of those people here. So it's cool to meet an LAan.
Right.
And then, so his story into filmmaking was really amazing. Like, he just, from dropping out of UCLA, which he thought that would be the end, but then he went to LACC because his friends were going there. Right. And then he went to storyboarding, to second unit director, working with Francis Ford Coppola to animation, and then directing and receiving an Oscar for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
So it was amazing hearing all that.
Yeah, it is a really great story. And, you know, I basically saw his talk at THU, and then I said, I want you to just go through that whole story again, because it was such an amazing journey that he takes. One of the things that I really thought was incredible about him, and he's a very humble person.
Oh, totally.
Right?
Yeah.
And every part of his story seems to be sort of something like, oh, I got lucky and I don't belong here.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I got lucky to hang out with Coppola in his office, but I don't belong here. And he belongs in all those places. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of that imposter syndrome that is so interesting that really is cool about him. He's an extraordinarily humble person and a really great guy. I really loved hanging out with him. I loved his stories. He's a really fascinating person. And really cool. I mean, I love his other nickname that he got, which I think we mentioned briefly on the podcast. After he directed Guardian, one of the reviews was he called him the Obama of animation, mm-hmm. which
yeah,
I thought was very,
cool.
very interesting as well. Very cool. All right. Well, Kristen, before we go on to the podcast, let's tell us about some of the events going on right now.
All right. We have a few events coming up in the next month, and you can find all this out at chaosgroup.com/events. So the first one is happening on November 15th in Dubai. We're having V-Ray and SketchUp present at the Design Week in Dubai.
Yeah.
And then November 19th through 22nd in Bangalore and Mumbai, V-Ray, and actually I think SketchUp will be there too. So we'll have V-Ray days in India. Discover what's new in V-Ray for architecture, design, VFX, and animation.
Nice. And then we have our student challenge. What's going on there?
So it started October 1st and it will go until December 1st. And you can sign up for it at facebook.com/chaosgroup. And our tag is explore your imagination and render the undiscovered.
Right. So go to our Facebook page there, which is facebook.com/chaosgroup to find out more about that. And of course, if you guys are interested in more of the podcast, you guys can always go to our Facebook page for the podcast itself, which is facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast. You can also go directly to our own page, which is chaosgroup.com/CG Garage. And of course, as I always say every week, we would love to hear more from you guys, ideas for guests, etc. We have been getting some great suggestions, so please keep them coming. But if you guys also want to give us a review, we always appreciate that. If you're on Apple Podcast, reviews are welcome, and ratings are also welcome as well. So please go there and do that. And if you have any ideas and you don't want to go on social media, you can always email us, which is
labs@chaosgroup.com.
Thank you, Kristen. That being said, please enjoy this amazing podcast with Peter Ramsey.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I did see your talk. Really good talk.
Thank you.
I really appreciate
Thank
it. I was thinking about, you know, your backstory, which I think we should really let people know who are going to be listening to this, mm-hmm. a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. But I also thought about the fact that one of the themes that came along is
that everywhere you seemed to go, whether it was a success or a failure, you always had a sense of not belonging in that place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of.
You know?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Feeling a little bit out, even in your own environments and everything. You're always a little bit of a different person. So I've always had an interest in the people that feel that they are an outcast.
Right, right, sure.
So, but can you, you know, to give people an idea of what's going on and talking about that, let's talk a little bit about your origin story, since you're famous for doing an amazing superhero film about origin stories. Let's start with that.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me see. I was born in South Central Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's not really the stereotype, you know, bullets flying around and, you know, constant helicopters, like, you know, strafing you. Although, a lot of helicopters.
And yeah.
There definitely were, you know, gangs around when I grew up. But, you know, what really kind of characterizes that part of town is there's nice little quiet streets, you know, and grandmothers tending their rose bushes and, you know, nice lawns. There are some pockets, you know, or streets that are kind of like, you know, more troubled or worse. And
right.
And I think it's probably like any other, you know, city or part of the world where it's like, you have, you know, some areas that are just a little rougher than others, but our street was always kind of this, like, kind of fairly quiet blue-collar neighborhood.
Right.
You know, maybe once in a while something would impinge on our on our world. And my dad was a mailman, and my mom was at home with us. I have there were four of us kids altogether.
Right.
I have two brothers, one of whom is also a pretty well-regarded, very well-regarded, sorry, Eric, storyboard artist.
Yeah.
And both live action and animation.
Yeah.
And the other's a musician, and my sister Maria is an educational administrator in Atlanta right now.
Wow.
But anyway, my mom didn't work for probably the first 10, 11 years of my life, and then she became an educational aide at the elementary school that we all went to.
Yeah.
So it was like a, like, blue-collar upbringing.
Yeah.
Summer vacation, you know, a couple of years it was New Orleans to visit my mom's family.
Right.
But it was typically Disneyland.
Right.
It was like the big event, you know.
Wow. That's still pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad. Not bad. And that's, you know, we never complained. That was like awesome. But it was you know, we didn't have any connection to the industry.
Right.
You know, despite the fact that we lived, you know, maybe, you know, 10 miles from Hollywood, whatever it
right.
was. So I grew up not having any inkling that this was anything I could actually be a part of or work in.
You right.
know, movies and TV shows and all the other things I enjoyed were kind of like things that like fell out of the sky, and I had no real connection to that way other than I loved them and got this big emotional charge.
Right.
And so it was... yeah, I was telling the folks here at TA2, it's like, I'm probably, for me, it was just as remote as it is for somebody probably growing up in Czechoslovakia or, you know, for all practical purposes. I just didn't believe it was possible.
Right. You did mention, you know, you weren't necessarily, growing up, movies were not necessarily a big thing for you. And there was, you know, you would go to the movies maybe like twice a year.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Going out, I mean, I watched a lot of movies on TV.
Sure.
You know, but that was like you know, in those days, that was pre cable. It was
pre VHS.
Pre VHS, even, you know, for the first part of my life. And it was just like whatever you happened to stumble on.
Uh huh.
And then actually going to the movies was like, you know, like going to church at Easter and Christmas. I probably wouldn't like actually go out to the movies.
Right.
My, you know, because it was my dad who would take us. You
right.
know? And it would just happen a couple of times a year, probably.
Right.
But that was, you know, that was, I mean, and coincidentally, it's also the days before multiplexes. So when you went to the movies, you weren't really seeing movies on tiny little shoebox screens. You were seeing big screens.
Right.
So going to a movie was like, even if it was a movie you had no interest in, was like a big experience, you know?
Right.
And then when it was something that was big, like, you know, Pinocchio or like, I remember, I remember we saw Conquest of the Planet of the Apes
nice.
When I was pretty young, and that like blew my head off.
Right. Yeah, but those were also the days when movies would be in theaters for a long period of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'd be like second runs, or they'd right. like they would just play forever, and you're watching some scratched up old print.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I remember one point it was... it was E.T. E.T. was in theaters for 18 months.
Yeah, yeah. Movies. Well, Star Wars was like at the Chinese for like a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to go. By that time I was going to, Star Wars really like got me going to movies on my own.
Really?
And and I would hop on the 85 bus up Crenshaw Boulevard to all the way up to Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
And I would just like, I think I probably saw Star Wars 20 times in the theater.
Wow, there you
yeah,
go.
Just yeah. like over and over and over.
Well, that's amazing. I think that was really cool. You also mentioned that your dad had a big love of music.
Yes.
That was really nice.
Yeah, well, he originally came out to L.A. in the late 50s with the idea that he was going to become a jazz musician, and uh-huh. I don't think it lasted very long.
Right.
But he loved music. He was very musical, yeah. And he was a big jazz fan. But he was also a big fan of classical music.
Right.
He had studied music, gone to music school for a little bit, and developed this real love for classical music, like Beethoven and Mozart, Brahms, you name it, and also opera. He was a big opera fan.
Really?
Yeah. So at my house, on like I remember Sunday afternoons.
Yeah.
My dad would be blasting Beethoven's Fifth or arias from Madame Butterfly or Tosca, and I'm in drawing at the table or playing out in the backyard.
Right.
It was pretty wild. It's pretty incongruous, you would think, for you go to South Central LA, you're not expecting to
hear opera.
Hear the London Symphony Opera. But it's just it just goes to show you, you can't stereotype any place based on any thing, because you just don't know what people are actually into or doing, or how big their worlds are.
Right. Really. But you also mentioned you were drawing a lot, like you said.
Yeah.
So what was a kid, you liked to draw things, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think it was something that it developed just as a way to entertain myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. I don't know why I chose that as opposed to... Because I did everything. I played and played mm-hmm. sports and we played, baseball and football and basketball out in the street, or we had a little basketball hoop in the backyard. Mm-hmm. I had toys, all the stuff. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, I started drawing. I would draw little stories, little extended stories in the white spaces in my mom's magazines.
Right.
And I would just kind of use those to... I would fill up the margins of those with these little adventures.
Uh-huh.
And from there, I kind of started, I think the first thing I really started to draw was dinosaurs.
Yeah.
I was really into dinosaurs as a kid. Wanted to be a paleontologist. Knew all, I could tell you, all about just about any dinosaur.
Uh-huh.
And I would start copying the pictures from the dinosaur books.
Right.
And that just started to bleed over... I think probably until I started really getting interested in comics and realized that those were drawn and and that was like the little light bulb of, those are like drawn stories just like the ones I was doing in my little, books.
Right.
It was a form of entertainment and just exercising my imagination.
Right. I just had this vision when you were telling the story about when you were buying comic books. I mean, you didn't have like the classic comic book store.
It was Champ's Liquor Store.
Yeah.
Champ's Liquor Store. And it would always smelled like incense, and it was dark. And there was like, weed paraphernalia, pipes and stuff behind the glass case.
Right.
And black light poster with the sex positions of the Zodiac. And we would stop there and get candy on our way home after school.
Okay.
And I discovered, I saw this rack in the corner.
Uh-huh.
And my dad was a mailman, so I remember when I was a really young kid, once in a while, he would deliver comic book subscriptions. And they used to fold them up and have them in little brown paper envelopes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, people had moved or... the person was no longer at the address.
Right.
And I remember him bringing home comics once in a while. And I was, I would be fascinated by these things, but I didn't understand anything about them. They were Marvel comics.
Right.
I was too little to understand, and I think I would like burn them with magnifying glasses or whatever.
Right.
But for whatever reason, I had a friend in the third grade, my friend Colin Taylor, who was into comics.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of curious. And then I found this rack of comic books at Champ's Liquor Store.
Wow.
And they had comic books from like, that were like, they had stuff there that was like three, four years out of date.
Okay.
But
still actually, relevant though.
You yeah.
Still follow
and
along.
That's where I first bought my first ones with my own money. And it was
right.
like a
yeah
whole new world.
And so what did comic books teach you? What did you learn from comic books?
They were... For me, a few things. I mean, they were in terms of drawing and like dynamism, rendering the human body, even though it's superhero anatomy. Right. But you know, back in those days, there were a lot of comic artists that were a little more classical in their style, and they really knew how to draw.
Right.
You know, they were big guys who had come out of like the newspaper comic strip tradition where you were right. drawing newspaper comic strips about doctors and
right.
whatever.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, every character wasn't necessarily like a muscle-bound caricature. It was
right.
like, it was actually good drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, so that on the art side, that sort of started teaching me things about like how to like, you know, render form and spotting blacks on the page and
yeah.
things like that. And then beyond that, story-wise, you know, all the Marvel comics were pretty much soap operas with, you know,
yep.
kind of like superpowers.
Uh-huh.
And that was like the big revelation. Like, I remember reading my first Spider-Man comic, and there were a couple of panels where he was like going on about how he wished he wasn't Spider-Man and it was just a burden. And I was like, wait a minute, what? I didn't know it was like that. What is that? You know? And it was this whole other, like, this thing of, like, a complex character in these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it just intrigued me. And it just got me interested in the idea that a character in a story could have an inner life and a psychology that was at odds with what you would expect.
Right.
And that really, you know, that and just the... just the soap opera elements of, oh my God, he can't pay his rent, and oh my God, his best friend is his worst enemy, and
yeah.
you know, all that stuff just was like it just tapped into this vein of emotionality that I had kind of was already being fed by like the music my dad was listening to,
yeah.
by the cartoons I was watching, and
not dissimilar from opera, right?
Yeah, it's all kind of the same sort of emotional frequency, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So you found this thing, you know, about art, and you knew about drawing. It's like, this is you made a decision at some point. It's like, that's what I want to do. I want to study art, right?
Yeah, you know, I at some point along the way, I started to, and I'm not sure when it was. I think it was I was really into comic books, and I was trying to draw them myself, but I think I only ever completed like one comic book story that I ever did
right.
by the time I was in middle school. But by that time, I was pretty like, yeah, I think I want to be a comic. I think that's what I want to do, I think. But
right.
not really, you know, the way a kid thinks about it.
Sure.
Not really thinking about a career.
Right.
But more importantly than that, I guess, I kind of started identifying myself as an artist. As
right.
a guy who drew.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really that.
Yeah. So this... led to your interest at some point, you know, to go to college,
mm-hmm.
do that.
Right.
And you
right.
mentioned that your parents didn't go to college, so
no.
this is going to be, you know, something new for your family,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you went to UCLA, right?
UCLA. I got accepted to UCLA.
Yeah.
And I got accepted as a fine arts major.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, for me at the time, you know, I had art classes in high school, and
mm-hmm.
we drew with rapidographs, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're drawing, you know, wildlife pictures from National Geographic or whatever, and
uh-huh.
making them look as real as possible. And,
yeah.
And and I also had the comic book thing, and I'd like, you know, I had just discovered like Frank Frazetta, and there were a bunch of other comic book fantasy artists,
yeah.
Barry Smith and Bernie Wrightson and these guys
yeah.
that I was totally into. So for me, like, that was kind of art, you right. know? And if I wanted to really get fancy schmancy and intellectual about it, it was like really realistic artists like Andrew Wyeth or I'm trying to think of somebody else who I would have thought, wow, that's high art.
Yeah.
But, you know, not realizing there's a whole other world of art of, like, you know, abstract or non-figurative or
yeah.
the whole other universe of art that I really didn't know anything about.
Right.
But so I went into my first studio art class at UCLA,
yeah.
and the teacher said, we're going to be teaching this class entirely in photograms.
Right.
And I was, like, wait a minute, what's a photogram? Where's the little charcoal sticks and the paint and the...
Right.
And for those of you who don't know,
right.
a photogram is you take a sheet of photographic paper and you arrange objects on it and you expose it to light,
right.
and you can like get different layers of image by exposing more or less, you know, and
right.
you get really cool effects and it's really awesome. But I didn't know what that to me that was like, huh?
Right.
You know, I thought I was going to be painting, you know, barbarians and stuff.
Right.
So it led to a real kind of crisis of confidence in the idea that I was like, according to these people, I don't even know what art is.
Right.
And I didn't really. I mean, mm-hmm. years later, I learned the value of just about everything that I was being exposed to then.
Right.
I just wasn't ready for it when I was, you know, 17 years old.
Right.
So, but the thing what it kind of resulted in me turning away a little bit from the idea of being an artist, and I was gravitating much more toward literature, English literature class I had, and a mm-hmm. creative writing class,
uh-huh.
and that started like really firing on all cylinders for me. And at the same time, I had some older friends who were kind of like just starting to kind of like get really interested in film. As a serious thing, as like, you know, knowing who directors were and what they did and
right.
appreciating, like, you know, more mature movies, not just Star Wars and not
right.
just, you know, all those, you know, those are great, but the idea that film can, like, you know, express like real human stories and intellectual ideas and
right.
And that I started realizing.
And what year was this around?
This was around this was like the early 80s.
Okay. So it's just right 80s. After like the crazy independent films from the 70s and all the Taxi Drivers
yeah.
and all that and stuff.
Yeah,
right?
yeah, and it was like those films had come out, and I had always been a little too young to really get them.
Yep,
you know, and they had shown. I remember they had shown the Godfather saga on TV, and mm-hmm. my dad was a big fan of the Godfather.
Right,
and I would kind of watch, and it was really dark and mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
For me, all those movies were like, wow, this must be what it is to be an adult.
Right.
And I don't quite understand, but I want to, and it's mysterious, but I don't quite get it.
Uh-huh.
So by the time I had like really started my own movie going life, really starting with Star Wars,
right.
and like going all Spielberg and all the stuff of the early 80s.
Uh-huh.
My friends who were a couple of years older than me would take us to the New Art Theater
uh-huh.
in West LA, and
yep.
I remember seeing like probably on the second run The Duelists, Ridley Scott's The Duelists.
Oh wow, yeah,
and that was like that was like a whole different feel and style of storytelling, and
yeah,
and then there were like, you know, then it was like some of the old, you know, Chinatown I'd end up seeing, or
yeah,
like Mean Streets or Taxi yeah. Driver and. Just all these other films, and I was starting to kind of understand what movies could be beyond, you know, beyond just the big genre,
uh-huh.
you know, crazy adventure stuff, and also understanding that people made them and like what a director did.
Right, right. So your friends, you mentioned that they were going to film. So do you learn vicariously through them, or did you start taking some film stuff as well?
I actually took a couple. My good friend Dana.
Yeah.
Was taking film classes at Los Angeles City College.
Right.
And I was, you know, I had dropped out of UCLA by that time after 2 years. I
right.
was trying to figure out what I was going to do.
Right.
And it was like, oh yeah, I've been taking classes at LACC and taking a 16 millimeter class with this guy JP, and
yeah.
he would tell me about this stuff, and I was like, wow, this sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was really intrigued. So I took a couple of classes, and I had a great film history class.
Uh-huh.
It was a documentary film class that was fantastic.
Oh yeah.
And I did take a 16. There was for Super 8 class just to get your feet wet.
Yeah.
And then I took a Super 16 or 16 millimeter filmmaking class and made a little, you know, couple of little black and white 16 millimeter films. No sync sound, but just, you know, again, just kind of getting your feet wet and getting used to the idea. And then I was like, I was pretty hooked. And I also felt like I pretty quickly had an aptitude for it, because I think having kind of been trained in like visual storytelling from comics.
Yep.
And from having, you know, watched so many movies and soaking in film grammar and all that, that storytelling style kind of started falling into place pretty quickly for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember I went to architecture school at Rice University, and we didn't have room, and this is for grad school, and didn't have many room for electives, but I did end up taking filmmaking class, as a documentary filmmaking class, and I took a film history class, and that was just like, that really got me.
When you start getting introduced, like, because I remember in our film class, I think our teacher was a big fan of British film, and we saw a couple of like really early, she showed us some really early like British documentaries. It's called Night Mail.
Really?
Yeah, about it was by this guy John Grierson, and it was the British, like the British Film Board or whatever. And they would it was pre-war, or it might have been during the war. It was just a documentary about this train that delivered the mail through Britain at night.
Wow!
But it was pretty renowned for its use of sound, and it was kind of like a
interesting.
Yeah, and it was like just the thought that like, how could delivering mail on a train be interesting and cinematic?
Yeah,
but it was, and it was, and we saw Alexander Nevsky by Eisenstein.
Eisenstein, yeah,
and some early David Lean film. And so it was just getting an education in these kinds of filmmaking that were really different from anything I was used to. And then seeing movies at repertory theaters, like, you know, the new art
like, is great. Yeah.
You know, and I saw...
Still is great.
it's still great. Yeah, and it's all refurbished now.
Yeah.
But I remember they re-released Seven Samurai.
Oh, yeah.
It was the restored version.
Right.
And I went to see that. I really didn't know that much about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just like blew, just like just completely like a complete revelation.
Well, it's such an important film.
It's like the greatest movie of all time.
Yeah.
It's so
been replicated so many times in so many ways, you know.
Oh yeah. So it was like stuff like that. That was a real like golden era for me.
Right.
Like just discovering all kinds of movies and oddly enough, I think the moment that I really said, you know what, I think I want to be a director, was coming out of seeing E.T.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
Strangely enough, because we'd been kind of talking around it and had these little film classes actually it might have been before I took the film classes that we saw E.T. But came out of the theater and really had a great time in the movie, and just I was looking around the audience and how they were affected by the movie,
right? Yeah,
you know, and the end of that movie, it's for that kind of movie, it's really powerful.
Yes,
you know, and like for a mass audience to be like in the grip of one person's imagination like that, I was kind of looking around, and that I was really like, man, I would really love to be able to do that.
Right,
I think that's what I want to do.
Right, well, that's a good, and I think it's, you know, part of that our generation too, of being kids and understanding things and their independence. That makes sense. Absolutely, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So you were taking some film classes,
mm-hmm.
and you were also working at a bookstore around that time,
yes.
Right?
Right. I was working at a bookstore. Because I was paying for my car,
right?
And I couldn't, you know, it was a thing where I had. You know, I had dropped out of UCLA, and at first I thought, man, I'm really more interested in like English lit or movies. But I, you know, I had looked into going to the film school there and trying to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it was a thing where you had to make films and you had to pay for your own stuff.
And it's expensive.
Like, I could not afford it.
Right.
And, you know, this was, you know, listeners, this was at a time before, you know, digital media. So, like, you know, you're talking
film.
Equipment rentals, film, transfer, just like it was super expensive back then.
Right.
Movies. So I just didn't have that option. And even at LACC, I got to a certain point and it was like, I can't really afford to go further because, you know, I'm paying for my car. And then, yeah, I kind of want to, you know, kind of want to move out, you know. Mm-hmm. I was moving out of my parents' place, so mm-hmm. I was starting to pay rent, and so I was just kind of, you know, I wasn't making much money and living hand to mouth, but by that time I think I had decided I think I want to try and do it, and I think I'd started writing on my own by
mm-hmm.
then,
because mm-hmm.
I had read I started educating myself in film, and I was basically just reading every film book I could get my hands on.
Right.
And the big, I remember Spike Lee when She's Gotta Have It
mm-hmm.
came out. That was a huge, like, oh my God, he's wild. A black dude is making a movie, and he did it by himself, and it's about black people. And,
right.
And that was like, that was another huge revelation. That was like, you can make movies out of your own experience.
Yeah.
Which is gigantic. And he had written this great, there was a great book, which was basically his journal of making that movie.
Sure.
And it's all about, like, day by day, like, I had to borrow $200 from, you know, so-and-so to buy this for the movie. And I had to, you know, so-and-so was bugging me about getting to the set. And I told him he had to take the train. We don't have any drivers.
Right.
And it was real, like, wow, this was like a real account of somebody just making a movie by, like, you know, like, just ground level. I was like, I could almost do that.
Yeah.
And so that was really inspiring. And I had read Akira Kurosawa's autobiography, and he literally said, if you want to be a film director, you must first write scripts.
Right.
And I think I, like, you know, like, threw the book aside and, like, started trying to write something, like, right that same day.
Because
I really wanted to, like, I really wanted to figure it out.
Right. But tell us a story about how you got into the storyboard.
Yeah. Well, storyboarding, you know, so it's around this time I'm working, like, you know, I have a job. There was an architecture bookstore called Hennessy and Ingalls that I
got
a job at. Yeah, I worked at Hennessy and Ingalls.
Okay, so that's in Santa Monica.
Yeah, and I had, before that, they were on Pico and Westwood.
Uh-huh,
and I was working, I would do the stock, I would offload the trucks with the books, and I'd open the boxes and do all that stuff. So, and we moved over to Santa Monica. I was there for a few years.
Right.
And I had a little early, along the way, I had accidentally met a film editor in the bookstore. I didn't know who he was. We just started talking, and he kind of ended up saying what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my God. And, you know, whatever movie he worked on, I was like, oh yeah, I saw that, we like, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, he was kind of jazzed that I was, you know, into what he was doing.
Right.
And he asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, oh, I don't know. I think I want to be an illustrator or something like that.
Right.
Because even then, I hadn't really thought of working professionally in film.
Right.
And so this guy told me, oh, I know an illustrator. I'm working with a guy at Paramount Pictures on the, you know, the movie I'm working on now. You should come meet him. I was like, what? Really?
Yeah.
I said, yeah. So I went up there. He got me in, got me onto the lot to come visit.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was a guy named Maurice Zuberano,
uh-huh.
who was a storyboard artist. And he had worked with, like, he had worked in, like, Hitchcock films.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like, amazing. And, and he took a look at, you know, I had sketchbooks with me, took a look and was like, oh yeah, you could do this. You're good enough. And blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's incredible. But I still didn't know how.
Sure.
And not long after that, I found about an agency that repped storyboard artists for advertising.
Right.
And they were just starting to rep people for getting into movies.
Okay.
And by this time, I had, like, you know, I had a couple of friends who had little jobs, like, on the fringes of the business.
Sure.
And I had, like, you know, I'd gotten a little gig, like, painting a mural on the set of this movie about weightlifting.
Uh-huh.
and you know, just a little super fringy in, industry job.
Sure.
But nothing real. But I applied to this, tried to get on with this agency. Mm-hmm. They rejected me the first time.
Right.
And like 6 months later, the guy who owned the agency came back into the bookstore and right. saw me. And I was like, hey, apply and didn't you send a portfolio in?
Uh-huh.
And I was like, yeah, but didn't work out. You guys rejected me. And I had kind of like given up on the idea.
Right.
And he just told me, try again. Do some new samples and try again. So I did. And they accepted me and right. I started getting work.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was really wild.
Well, that just goes to show people they shouldn't just give up on the first rejection.
Don't. The door can, you know, you can always come and knock on the door again and
right.
find out why it didn't work out. Don't be so hurt that you completely give up. You
know? Right.
It might not be all you. It might be some other combination of circumstances that you just don't know.
Right. So you got in.
So I got in and they started, started getting work on like a little, you know, rinky dink, you know, commercials that just like right. you know, like from tiny production companies who just were doing some local access ads at first.
Right.
But then I started getting bigger stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up doing a lot of boards for I would do shooting boards. There was a couple of times I was working more with ad agencies,
mm-hmm.
but I ended up doing more shooting boards for actual the directors of the commercials.
Okay.
And that was good. Because yeah. I was actually working with guys who were going to be shooting them. And so I started learning a little about what that job was really all about.
Right.
And then at the end, around the end of the first year, true to their word, they got me a movie.
Wow.
And it was a movie that was never made.
Yeah.
It was about Michelangelo carving the Statue of David.
Okay.
And as luck would have it, they wanted to do location scouting while we were storyboarding.
Wow.
So I got to go to Florence
nice.
For several weeks. And so we ended up storyboarding that whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it never got made, but I had this huge stack of samples now.
Right.
And based on that, I started getting other work.
Awesome.
And yeah, I think the next movie I got after that was Nightmare on Elm Street 5.
Oh, wow.
I think.
Nice.
And then in the next couple of movies, one of those went union, and I got into the union.
Right.
And then I was like, then I was like working on like legit Hollywood movies,
right?
Which was wild.
So yeah, you were on set on the MGM lot, or was it?
Yes.
Lot.
So I think by that time it was still Columbia. It had gone through a couple of names.
Right.
But it was Columbia just going. It was. I think it was just becoming Sony.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll tell them that story because I thought that was a fantastic story.
The Dracula one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, so fairly early on in my career, I had lucked into getting a storyboarding job on Bram Stoker's Dracula by Coppola. And it was, I'd kind of angled for it because I had heard about it, but I'd also heard they were all booked up.
Right.
And a friend of mine who had been at the same agency as me, Dave Lowry, who was like king of the storyboard artists,
right.
was on it. And I was like, oh my God, if only there was a way to get on this movie, I would do anything.
Right.
And he said, oh yeah, well actually, I'm going to be leaving in about a month to go work on, he was probably going to work on like Jurassic Park.
Or something.
And so, I can put in a word for it. I was like, really?
Right.
Please? If that happens. And it happened.
Right.
So I got on. And I got on, and I remember the first day I met Francis
right.
was in the bungalow where he had his office.
Okay.
And there was like a little corner desk that he would write at, and there was a big conference table. And it used to be it was built for Joan Crawford back in the 40s.
Uh-huh.
So it had these wooden Venetian blinds.
Yes.
And I remember when I went in and met him for the first time, the blinds were kind of half drawn. So it was this total Godfather style lighting.
Yes.
And he was so great and so nice to me. And he loved the idea of working with younger people and being around like the energy of, I think it reminded him of his youth. And I'd been drawing for a couple of weeks already. So he was leafing through my boards and, you know, he was telling me, oh, it's so great that you're here to help us work on the movie. And
right.
I hope you have a good time. And, you know, we're really going to be trying a lot of different things. And he asked me, oh, have you ever seen the silverfish? Uh-huh. And from reading about him, I knew, oh, that's his super cool, like, teched out, you know, Airstream trailer. Uh-huh. He brought me back and showed me the silverfish.
Wow.
And yeah, it was like, it was really like Willy Wonka's.
Yeah.
You know, it was like having him take you through the chocolate factory.
Right.
So, you know, he kind of took me under his wing a little bit because he saw what a big, you know, fan I was.
But he also knew you were thinking about directing at this point.
Yeah. I mean, he could, you know, we would chit chat and I'd say, oh yeah, I would love to, you know, be a director someday. And
I'm
writing and I'm doing this. And he took it seriously.
Yeah.
So there was this one day, it was a story I told at THU. There was this one day, sometimes I would work at the big conference table. I would draw and he'd be sitting writing, you know, revising the script in the corner. And, sometimes he'd chit chat back and forth. And a few Sony executives came in one day to talk to Francis. And I was like kind of picking up to leave to give them some privacy. And he said, no, it's okay. You can stay here.
Right.
And those guys pulled up some chairs and they sat down and they started talking, you know, budget and schedule and, you know, are you going to hire so-and-so or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting and drawing and kind of like half, you know, listening and half pretending like I'm not listening.
Right.
And so the meeting breaks up and these guys leave and Francis comes over and I'm just drawing like, you know, I've been, you know, being a good student or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he just claps a hand on my shoulder and he goes, as a young director, it's really important that you should like be able to hear discussions like that once in a while so you can get an understanding of how things work on the studio level on a film like this.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was just like, he called me a young director. It was just overwhelming.
It was
absolutely overwhelming.
Yeah.
And it was, and all through that thing, he was like, you know, because I would like, you know, he liked what I was doing in the storyboards.
Mm-hmm.
I was working with his son Roman a lot. We kind of bonded and
we
would figure out some of those practical gags together. And
I would
have ideas for shots sometimes and Francis, oh my God, that's great. Give me more ideas, more like that.
Right.
And it was just fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic. It was like that whole thing was such an amazing roller coaster ride that I learned so much from it.
Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. Because, you know, sometimes people don't necessarily, they want to mentor people to their same level. They don't want them to sort of go up a level.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
That's a big thing in Hollywood is if people think you're good at something, a lot of times they want to keep you doing that and keep you in that box.
Right.
Francis and also John Singleton was the same way, was like always ready to like give you a leg up and like, you know, he, you know, when he realized I was actually like really interested in directing, he was like, you know, we need some second unit shots on Poetic Justice, his second movie.
Yeah.
And he was like, I bet you could do those. And I was like, really?
And then you get experience on set.
You
could do that.
Exactly. Yeah. I was working with a real crew and we had a, you know, a camera car and all this stuff. That was just like, it was absolutely amazing.
Second unit's kind of fun.
It is kind of fun. you're kind of, you know, you can try goofy things sometimes.
Right.
As long as you make sure you get some stuff that could go in the movie.
Right.
But I was super lucky. So I got to do that for John a couple of more times.
Nice.
And then I kind of wangled my way into a really big second unit on this movie, Tank Girl.
Oh, right, Tank Girl. Yeah.
Tank Girl. And that was directed by Rachel Talalay and starring Lori Petty.
Uh-huh.
I was storyboarding on that movie, and by this time I had done maybe two, three second units, you know, for John, and I was kind of feeling like, okay, I think I'm kind of getting this, you know? And I remember I was working on storyboards for an action sequence in the movie, and I was like, I'm going to do a real kick-ass job on this action sequence, and I'm going to tell them I want to do the second unit.
Right. Yeah.
And I was really feeling cocky.
Uh huh.
And it worked.
Okay.
I was amazed. I turned in the first sequence and like they loved it. Rachel and the producer Aaron Warner, they flipped and they loved it. And I was like, oh well, man, I just like I is there a way I could throw my hat in for, you know, to direct second unit?
Sure.
And Rachel said, oh, your hat's in the ring. Your hat's in the ring.
Uh-huh.
And they actually gave it to me.
Nice.
And then I found out how big it was, and I was, like, stunned.
Wow.
Because it was, like, a 75-person crew.
Wow.
Yeah. There was, like, the special effects. There were stunts. There were, like, big vehicles.
Of course.
There was, like, gunfire and explosions. And it was, like,
yeah.
Oh my God! I think this isn't just bit off a little more than I could chew.
This isn't just B-roll and driving shots, right?
Oh yeah, exactly, exactly. And it was so funny because I'll never forget the guy who was the second unit DP was this guy, Michael Bennett was his name.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he was just like one of these real like cowboy DPs.
Yeah.
His he had been shooting second unit on like. I don't know if it was like a Cameron film or a Stallone film or something. Right. And it was pretty famous. Or maybe it was the movie Dante's Peak or something.
Okay.
He had been in do you remember a story about a guy, a camera crew that was in a helicopter and it crashed in a volcano?
Yes.
He was one of the guys who crashed in the volcano.
Wow.
So first day we're talking and I'm like, oh crap, this guy's actually going to listen to me.
Yeah.
It was like the scene in Aliens where the Marines are like, how many combat drops you been on?
Right.
And the commander goes, 3, 2 simulated.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I was just like, I was pretty in over my head, but like, I kind of faked my way through it the best I could.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I got exposed and they were like, oh boy, this guy's green.
Right.
But then there were a couple of other times that, you know, because of my storyboarding mm-hmm. skills, it really kind of saved me because I really could like this, and this.
Right.
And we could just go bam, 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 and get stuff that was usable and that worked and that cut.
Yeah.
So that was pretty good. Yeah. So that kind of saved my ass because everything else I was just like, well, I kind of know what I'm doing, but.
So there was at some point you got into animation, right?
Right.
So how did that journey happen?
It really was a result of working on Tank Girl because Aaron Warner, who had produced Tank Girl, and you know, the second unit shooting, it was that whole shoot was really difficult. Tank mm-hmm. Girl, our second unit, like actually, kind of like did really, really well.
Sure.
So a couple of years later, Aaron called me mm-hmm. and he was like, "Hey, I'm at DreamWorks Animation and I'm working on this thing called Shrek."
Mm-hmm.
It's 3D animation. Would you be interested in coming and checking it out?
Sure.
And I was kind of like, I'm not really an animation guy. And, you know, and at the time, I think I was probably storyboarding on Fight Club.
Okay.
And I was sort of like, sounds great, but thanks, maybe, you know,
right.
Some other time, blah, blah. And I really liked Aaron, so, you know, I definitely didn't blow him off.
Right.
I was polite about it.
Right.
But so a few years go by, and in that time, of course, Shrek becomes this phenomenon. Mm-hmm. 3D animation kind of takes on it this whole life of its own.
Right.
You know, it looks really interesting and cool. And he calls me again when Shrek 3 is ramping up. And he says, mm-hmm. hey, I'm going to try you again because we're ramping up on another Shrek. And I'd love for you to come out and check it out. I think you'll see that it's a really pure form of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I think you have a lot of skills that would really benefit the studio. And I think you would be a good choice to direct something here.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh. And you know, by that time I had done a few second units, but I was starting to see that studios really seem to gravitate toward people who bring a big secondary skill when they're looking at second unit people.
Right.
Like a visual effects person or a stunt, you know, somebody who can like bring that another whole department to bear while they're doing a second unit.
Right.
Instead of just being another pair of eyes.
Right.
So I was like, okay, I'll come check it out. I'll take a look.
Right.
And I went to visit DreamWorks and I was blown away by the, you know, it feels like you're going to an art school or something. Mm-hmm. It's all about the art. There's art everywhere. People are respected as artists,
yep.
You know. and the craft of animation story is very different from what I was used to with live action storyboarding.
Right.
It's much more about designing, you know, the character's emotional journey, and your that kind of like got me excited, because the side of me that was into writing and, you know, coming up with story myself,
right,
wasn't getting fed on the storyboard side, where it's just like, here do the car chase, here comes the special effects scene,
right,
here's the left.
Right.
So I went over there intending, you know, just thinking I'd maybe be doing some storyboards on Shrek 3 for like 6 months. And
right,
they kept like offering me things. Oh, could you develop this little Puss in Boots story? Oh, here, could you do this? Here, we want you to be the head of the story department on Monsters vs. Aliens.
Right.
You know, this movie, we want these gigantic epic combat scenes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You'd be great with that stuff.
Yeah.
And and then I they asked me to direct, after Monsters vs. Aliens, they asked me to direct a half-hour Halloween special for TV.
Okay.
Based on Monsters vs. Aliens.
Oh, yeah?
So I spent like a year doing that, and it aired on NBC, and it was did really great, and they mm-hmm. were super happy. And right around the time after that, there was another production at the studio that was kind of troubled. It was a movie called Guardians, based on some children's books that by William Joyce.
Right.
And they wanted to change out creative teams.
Right.
So I had come off the Halloween thing. It had gone really well, and they were like, we want you to come on board and take this movie on.
Right.
And it was like
that's a full feature, right?
Yeah, it's a big feature, and yeah, it was like, so it, that was like, I've made it to the top of the mountain, you
right
know? And it was this pretty huge deal.
Yeah.
Pretty huge deal.
Yeah, it was a really interesting story about, you know, you coming up with it and doing what you're doing, and then the narrative you tell, you know, or you told me about the reviews and everything that was coming out, and how all the hype and excitement around.
Yeah.
It. So tell them about that. So how's that?
Yeah.
How that?
No, I mean the making of the movie. It was interesting because for a long time, DreamWorks, they had a reputation for doing a certain, you know, kind of like, you know, knowing winky meta comedy,
mm-hmm.
and the way we had ended up deciding to go with Guardians was not that at all. It was mm-hmm. it was a much more we knew that people hearing about, oh, DreamWorks is going to do a Santa Claus movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, is he going to fart? Is he going
right. to, yeah,
you know, it's going to be a lot of jokes about, you know, cell phones and whatever. And,
right.
And when you looked at the material that William Joyce had come up with,
right,
it was really sincere. It really dug into the idea of myth and belief and all this stuff that really felt a whole lot deeper.
Right.
So we were kind of crafting the story that way, and basically kind of trying to make this epic for like 10-year-olds,
right,
was the deal. Because it was like, you know, the earlier take on Guardians was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The version that they couldn't get to fly story wise,
mm-hmm.
but it sort of some of it was a little on the darker side. This kind of revisionist mm-hmm. take on these guys, and it kind of felt a little the thing that I didn't want to do, I felt like I don't really want to make a movie about these childhood characters that's going to sort of like that's gonna reinvent them in a way that kids wouldn't like, that felt like a betrayal of how kids saw them.
Right.
I was much more interested in the way that kids, the way that kids looked at these guys. I mean, I was thinking one day, I was like, man, when you're a kid, you kind of believe in Santa Claus before you really believe in God.
Right.
You know, it's yeah. like the idea of Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy
right.
is as much or more real to you
right.
as any deity or like, you know, religious philosophy that
right.
you could imagine.
Right.
Because you could see the effects in your life, you know,
like. Right.
December 24th, there's nothing under the tree. December 25th, oh my God, he came. You
right,
know?
Yeah.
And it's, so that whole idea of belief and making it tangible and all that stuff was kind of the basis of where we went with the movie. Anyway, all that to say, it was a wild ride making it. I was a little bit of a junior partner because there had been this earlier version, and the producer Christina Steinberg, who was actually a great producer, she was there, and the studio folks who had been developing it over there. So I was a little bit of me jumping onto a moving train and starting, painting some walls a different color and moving some things around working with David Lindsay Abaire, who was like a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright. So I was like, another one of those situations where it's like, oh my God, I'm supposed to tell this guy what to do.
Right.
And, I was a director, so I had to kind of step up. And Guillermo del Toro came on as an executive producer.
Yeah.
So, he was there and helping us, I remember he came in and we had a big restructuring session with the movie, and he helped us with that. And a lot of it was just a phenomenal time. And we were having a great time. And bit by bit, the movie was kind of coming together and people were starting to get really excited about it because it felt really different from all the other DreamWorks movies.
Right.
It also felt like it did have this kind of sincere epic fantasy quality that really felt like it was... coming together, and by the time we started test screening it was testing like through the roof,
right?
And I talked to people after the test screenings coming out of the theater, and they'd go, man, grown men would be like, man, I gotta tell you, I cried a couple of times, I felt like a kid watching the movie, and blah blah blah, blah. Right. And it was going fantastic, and the expectations were like getting higher and higher and higher, but then the movie came out, and it was like you could hear a pin drop. It's like hardly anyone knew that the movie was out there.
Right.
It was bizarre. I mean, it did like, it's weird because it was, DreamWorks was used to you look at the numbers for the Shrek openings.
Right.
I think Shrek 2 opened to like 100-something million dollars.
Right.
On their first, I'm not sure how many days, or first opening 5 days or whatever it was.
Right.
And it was crazy. And the Disney movies, of course, they always, their marketing machine was so great that they always opened gigantic. And ours was like, we were like, Puss in Boots had opened like a year before us, and we were like, we couldn't even beat that. And we were like, what the hell happened?
Yeah.
And it was like, I could go on forever.
Right.
It's marketing, it's like the date that we opened, but bottom line, it was like not that many people knew that the movie existed,
Right.
And the way they marketed it didn't really tell anybody about what was new about it. Mm-hmm. You just saw kind of like, a bunch of elves running around, and it was... a lot of the trailers were trying to imitate like the Minions stuff, which was a huge hit at the time.
Right.
So so after this incredible experience of making this film and
I remember you were telling me one of the first reviews, they called you the Obama of animation.
Oh, right. Yeah. It was like, this was before the movie came out.
Right.
We were doing press for it.
Right.
And it was all this hype about, oh my God, because I was the first African American director to direct one of the new wave of big CG animated films.
Right.
Bruce Smith actually was the first African American director to direct an animated film.
Okay.
With Bebe's Kids, but
right.
I was kind of the first of one of these in the Toy Story era.
Right.
Shrek era, whatever. So there were people were, based on our trailer and a few, some screenings of the movie.
Right.
We were like shortlisted for the Oscar and all this stuff. We did get nominated for a Golden Globe,
but
not an Oscar.
Uh-huh.
So the release of the movie, it was like a big I don't want to say scandal, but it was like it was like a shock in the industry.
Right.
And a lot of people had their it was interesting because a lot of people had their like knives out for DreamWorks,
Okay.
There had been a lot of, I think people inside animation know that there's always been a lot of bad blood between Jeffrey Katzenberg and a lot of the guys who were at Disney and split off and became Pixar.
Right.
So there was always like an anti-DreamWorks faction within within the animation world.
Industry, right?
Yeah. Yeah, who felt like they didn't like the smirkiness and the cynicism of some of the films.
Right.
But interestingly, they copied that smirkiness and cynicism themselves a lot.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, so there were a lot of factors that made the release of the movie as opposed to the making of the movie really weird.
Yeah, that's interesting. I want to make sure we have enough time before you. I mean, I know you have something you need to get to, but
yeah, I'm all good.
Okay, good. So I want to the other thing that you obviously that was something that was a bit of a shock and a disappointment, right?
Yeah,
and you didn't really know, you probably. Figure out, you can't blame yourself for this, or do you blame yourself for this?
Yeah, you go back and forth, and like, I mean, inevitably you're gonna go, boy, if I had done X, Y, or Z, if I had said no instead of yes to that idea,
right?
But there's like, I mean, yeah, it's hard to, it's really hard to know because I think that movie could definitely be 10-15% better than it was,
right?
But then, even if it was, would that have made the difference? Because
you said that it did really well when it came out on video.
Oh, it did great! Yeah, it did great. And like, and it's like, and honestly, it's like I said, our test scores were so high that the studio was like, they thought we were gonna make gazillions. I mean, it really was a bizarre weird Bermuda Triangle kind of situation.
Yeah.
And even, I mean, to this day, I get people, telling me how much they love it and they watch every Christmas and they oh, that's the movie that made me become an animator or a story artist. And we were actually reviewed, very well.
Right.
There were some nasty ones, but a lot of those were sort of, a lot of it was kind of predicated, a lot of people were offended by the idea that you would kind of try to reinterpret these characters at all. Mm-hmm. Some of them just saw that as a cynical thing in and of itself.
Hmm.
Yeah, I can't, I it's hard to defend against that one, but.
Sure, sure. So how did this eventually, you continued in animation, right? So
yeah, I was sort of like, it was a real body blow.
Right.
And the whole studio was like affected by it.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, in large part because of the way that studio was structured.
Mm-hmm.
It was like their model was kind of like, okay, every time we go to bat, we got to hit a home run because of the way studios run.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't hit a home run, there can be consequences.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like this thing where you're like, you're rolling sevens at the table, and the minute you don't,
right,
for whatever reason, you're in trouble,
right.
And that was kind of it. But even worse, I think the Croods came out after that, and it did much better,
sure,
than us. Opened at a different time in the year too, and
right.
But the couple of movies after that. Really did like worse. So there was something happening at the studio that wasn't quite going right.
Right.
And I was still there, and it was there was a tradition there that you're like, well, you after you get off a project, you come back, and sometimes you'll go help on other movies.
Yeah.
You'll like consult, or you're like, working story, helping with sequences, whatever. So was kind of doing that. I was working on new ideas, stuff to pitch there.
Yeah.
I was going back to writing a bunch of my own stuff that I hadn't had time to do during Guardians.
Sure.
But I was like, okay, I got a little more time now.
Yeah.
And but at DreamWorks, they had the next few movies on the slate, and it was like, that's the next couple of years.
Right.
And it's like, there's like no room for me for like, to make a movie there for like 2, maybe 3 years.
Right.
And I it was also like, I had always been a little bit of an outlier there because my sensibilities, which turned out to be kind of right for Guardians,
mm-hmm.
I'm in a kind of a small niche when it comes to mainstream animated films.
Right.
So the other stuff that they wanted to do, it just didn't really fit with where I was.
Uh-huh.
So they were kind of like, and I was kind of like,
Uh-huh.
And so and it was like a mutual parting of the ways, like probably at the around the end of 2014.
Okay.
And yeah, so that was, you know, I kind of said goodbye to DreamWorks.
Right.
And I think by the spring of the next year, I got a new gig, and that was with Avi Arad.
Okay. So what was that?
So Avi Arad was a guy who had started Marvel Films. He had been behind both animated versions of Spider-Man and X-Men.
Right.
And he also produced the X-Men movies, the very first Marvel.
Yes.
X-Men movies, and he had produced Iron Man.
Yeah.
And but he had always been involved in animation.
Right.
And he had made this deal with a couple of Chinese companies to produce a big animated feature that would be based on an idea set in China, but he wanted it to be for a global audience.
Okay.
So he asked, you know, he hired me to come on and develop that movie.
Right. And so you were going to work on this big Chinese animation thing, right?
Yeah. So I'm working. I signed the deal.
Right.
I'm like, ooh, God, thank God somebody's hiring me. I'm
right.
So happy to, you know, get behind the wheel again. And a couple of weeks after I sign, I hear people around the office talking about Spider-Man.
Right.
And I go, oh, what's up, Avi? Are you doing another Spider-Man movie? And he's, oh yeah, we're doing an animated Spider-Man feature at Sony.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
That's nice. Okay. Spider-Man. More Spider-Man. That's fine.
Yeah.
And he says, Phil Lord and Chris Miller are going to produce it.
Right.
And I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Now that's interesting.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, yeah, your name was on the list to direct, but I told him you already had a job.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow. Thanks. Okay. That's great. So back to work on the China film. And
yeah.
I, you know, it's over the next... you know, 6-7 months, I guess. I'm rewriting the script.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually having a pretty good time. I'm working with a really cool character designer, Patrick Awa, to design characters.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing tests with animation houses to
yep.
see.
Oh,
sorry about
it's okay.
that. To see who was going to do the actual animation.
Yep.
And we had settled on D Negative in London, and
they. Uh-huh.
We did a great test with them. We were all really excited about it. And it was all going great. And toward the end of 2015,
yep.
One of the big Chinese companies like pulled out of the deal. And
right.
the whole house of cards just collapsed.
Wow.
And the movie just like poof, just
yep.
vanished.
Yeah.
So by that time, my friend Bob Persichetti, who I'd known from DreamWorks,
right.
had gotten the gig to direct on Spidey.
Yes.
And when he heard about it, he gave me a call and said, hey, man, I heard you might have some time on your hands.
Uh-huh.
Why don't you come board on Spidey? I would love to have you come work on it.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, sure. That'd be cool.
Right.
Right. And yeah, I had heard Bob had gotten it, and I had a little twinge of, you know, jealousy for a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but I had pushed it away. But.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I was going to go board on it.
Mm-hmm.
And Avi was really happy about it because, you know, he was hoping that the China project was going to come back up and mm-hmm. that he'd be able to go, hey, Peter, we're back in business.
Right.
You know, come off Spider-Man and come do this again.
Right.
And but it didn't.
Uh-huh.
And so I was on Spider-Man boarding with Bob. And
yeah.
Was really excited about the direction that it looked like they were going in.
Yeah.
And at the time, and got to read Phil Lord's first treatment, and then a
yeah.
little later his first draft, and they
yeah.
were just like, "Wow!" They just had this real unique emotional quality about them, and super inventive, really funny, but really like heartfelt in a real I don't know. There was just this fresh quality to the sincerity of
sure.
of what he had written that was, I felt like, man, this is going to be really special if it can be done right.
Yeah. And it had a look to it, right? That's going to be special.
Well, yeah. And at the time, the only art that existed was stuff that Alberto Mielgo
yes.
had done. He had done a bunch of production paintings that were just like They were beautiful.
Yeah.
And he has this, Alberto's got this real almost photorealistic style.
Yeah.
But when you look a little closer, you can see it's slightly stylized.
Right.
But it looks almost photoreal, and it's just like dazzling. And he was already doing stuff like the sound effects on the image and stuff like
right.
that. Which, you know, they had been saying, oh yeah, we want to incorporate comic book stuff into it.
Right.
But a lot of that stuff had not been worked out to the extent that it was later when Justin Thompson became production designer mm-hmm. and kind of took off from what Alberto had done and like just kind of like took it up into the stratosphere. Right.
Alberto just won 3 Emmys.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah, yeah, for his Witness
he's
thing.
He's brilliant. The guy is a mad genius.
So it was really an amazing look, and you guys really developed that.
Yeah.
So you were storyboarding on this, and then something happened where suddenly,
well, people started realizing how complex the production was going to be.
Yep.
Both technically and story wise.
Yep.
And the schedule was relatively short.
Yeah.
So they started going, you know what, we think everybody felt like it's just going to be too much for one director.
Yeah.
Then they asked me to come on board alongside Bob and co-direct with him. And I was
right.
like, here I go. I'm on. Wow. Look at that. Wow.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. But it happened. And so, yeah. And then we were kind of off and running. And then Rodney, Phil and Chris had left to do Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
So the script was, you know, the script was humongous.
Yep.
And Bob and I had been battling to cut it down for a while. And then Rodney Rothman came on and he had done a couple of drafts that kind of really got it in the ballpark. And to keep Rodney around, because I think, you know, to keep a writer around for that long, of Rodney's stature, it was more convenient to make him a director.
Sure.
So it was like Rodney became part of the team. And then it was all about, we were developing the look and the fee and the visual style and then hashing out the story.
Right.
And then Phil and Chris, you know, they, you know, came off of Solo early.
Right.
And then they plugged in and became an integral part of the team.
Right.
And then it was just like,
yeah,
hell or high water.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. I remember when I saw the trailer to it, I was like,
oh yeah.
Because, you know, and you actually sort of, you mentioned a little bit in your first reaction, is like, and it's Spider-Man's like, oh, how many Spider-Mans mm-hmm. do we have, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then I saw the trailer and I was like, this is going to be something completely different.
Yeah.
I was really excited. My kids wanted to go see it, so I was like, I told the family, I was like, we're all going to go see this. And my wife was like,
Right.
She'd never seen the trailer. She'd never seen anything. So she went into it with a completely blank.
Wow.
And she walked out of it. She's an artist too. She walked out of it. She goes, that is the most beautiful thing I have seen in years.
Yeah.
And it was just mind blowing.
Yeah.
So it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I was love it. And it's
thank you.
It's not just the look, it's obviously the story, it's the characters. Everything was like this perfect ensemble.
Yeah.
And I was really, really impressed.
Yeah.
Really impressed.
Thank you.
And, you know, we all know, you know, it won the Oscar, which I think was like, I was rooting for it. It's like, if anything beats that, it's not fair. The system is rigged. And I was just very much, very impressed. And you were going against some really amazing
shows. Oh, yeah.
But there was something so unique about that it needed the recognition that I think it needed. That it definitely got. Mm. I was, I'm sure it was tough. I'm sure you
guys. Yeah, it was really tough.
Yeah.
It was really tough.
Right.
It was crazy. I mean, I guess a lot of it was because, you know, some of the stuff we were, that, you know, a lot of the stuff on the technical side, you know, hadn't really been done before. But honestly, from my perspective, I mean, the tough thing was getting the story to like, to getting Miles's story to stay vibrant through the whole thing, to juggle all those characters, juggle the concept of the multiverse, and you know, it's just like fitting all those pieces in the right way and making them sing, and and you know, and it's, you know, working with Phil and Chris, man, they're like relentless,
right?
Just absolutely relentless about like pursuing every avenue, pursuing every, you know. It was just like, oh my God. And then the push just to like make it wilder, make it bolder, you know, don't hold back, just like, you know, push it as far as it can be pushed.
Yeah.
And and every person who worked on that movie gave 115%.
That's amazing. Definitely shows. You know, I want to kind of go back mm-hmm. to, you know, what I was saying at the beginning, that, you know, you did some of the things in your talk, it's always seemed like you always seem to talk about how you felt like you didn't belong, right? Like mm-hmm. like you're always an out person. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to David Prescott about it.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he told me, it's like, you should ask Peter about his thoughts on the concept of imposter syndrome.
Yeah, right.
So I would love to hear, because, you know, obviously, you know, you do the right things. You did that. But what are some of your thoughts about that?
Oh, God. I mean, it's like I battle it even now.
Right.
It's one of those things. I've talked to so many people that deal with it mm-hmm. and are constantly afraid that they're, you know, that, oh my God, they're going to find me out that I don't like that I'm not as good as, you know, they think I am, or that I've been leading people to believe that I am.
Right.
But it's this weird thing. I was talking with a good friend of mine, John Underkoffler, who, John actually designed the gestural interface minority report.
Oh, right.
John designed that, and he kind of made a real one in his business.
I did a podcast with Alex McDowell.
So oh yeah, okay.
There you go.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah, so. Yeah. And I worked with Alex too.
Yeah.
So and we were talking one day, and it's this weird thing of like, you know, okay, you know that you're good at certain things.
Sure.
You know, and you know that you kind of know, kind. Intellectually, you know where you are,
right.
But there's something in you emotionally that just that doesn't want to believe that it's true, or still has a fear of rejection, or maybe because you don't know everything about something,
right.
That you feel like you have a vulnerable spot.
Yep.
And we kind of said, yeah, if only if only I could convince if only these idiots knew that I wasn't as good as that. Yeah. It's some version of being really egotistical, cool. And then terrified that people are going to find out,
yeah.
Like, you know, how short you're falling at the same time.
Right.
And it's, yeah, I don't know what it is, man. But I for me, I think part of it definitely comes from being mostly self-taught.
Yes.
And not having like,
you feel, you know, like there's a wealth of knowledge that you never acquired.
100%.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's like, oh, I never, you know, I didn't go to art school and I didn't go to film school and I didn't get the, you know, the official diploma that says that I know this.
Right.
You know, it's just like the Wizard of Oz. I never got my little diploma from the thing. So,
right.
So there's always this little well of like, and for me, coming from live action into animation, I've never animated anything.
Right.
You know, oh, okay, maybe I've done a little tiny bit. And, you know, in my boarding, I've, you know, done some little crude animation.
Right.
But I've never really, like, my actual knowledge of the technical side of animation is, like, shamefully limited.
Right.
You know, everything I know is about story, about performance, about, you know, that side of it.
Right.
And it comes much more from what I learned in my live action days,
right,
you know, and yet, you know, I've never directed a whole live action feature,
right,
you know, so I'm like in this, I don't know, I can always find this way to kind of say, oh, I don't know that, I'm a loser,
yeah,
I don't know why,
I suffer from it as well, a little bit,
yeah, everybody does, that's the revelation,
right, and so they should all realize you're not alone in feeling these feelings,
yep, exactly.
But you know, even in with complete success in a lot of ways you're doing, and you know, awards, everything else, you're like, do I deserve this?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
But I think it's what I also think it's healthy.
Yeah,
it keeps you humble.
Uh-huh. Yeah, probably definitely does that.
And but it also, I think it invigorates you to try harder for certain things as well,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely, like, and there was no way I was going to let anybody, like, you know, on either of the movies that I was involved in as a director, I was like, well, there's no way I'm going to be the weak link, man. I'm like, you know, I'm doing my thing. But yeah, I mean, And then the other part of it is like along the way realizing, well, you do learn stuff.
Sure.
And you do know things. So, you know, stop beating yourself up because you're not absolutely perfect. And like, you know, you get to a certain point in life and you can relax a little bit and feel have some confidence in what you actually do know.
Right.
And I think that really, just understanding that really helped me more than anything else. Like, you know, not to really freak out during the making of either of the movies that I've been involved in as a director. Because I'd been through the process so many times in live action.
Yeah.
That I'd been on these big movies and seen, like, you know, seen them go through rough patches. And I'd seen, like, big genius directors, like, not always know what to do.
Sure.
And somehow the movie always came out okay anyway. Or somebody else had a great idea and helped them through. Or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
There's always a way. So having that kind of perspective helps a lot. But, you know, I still kick myself and, like, worry that, you know, oh, my God, somebody's gonna realize that you don't really know what you're doing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So are you going to continue to do animation? Do you want to do action? You want to do live action as well?
I want to do both.
You're going to do both?
Yeah, I want to, but, you know... Live action, that was always my original, like, you know, from day one, I was like, I want to be Akira Kurosawa meets Orson Welles meets, you know, whoever, you know,
yeah.
That's what I want to be.
Yeah.
But I love animation, you know, I have a comfort level with the process now that, you know, despite my imposter syndrome,
right.
I feel like, okay, I think I'm getting my head wrapped around.
You should.
This.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just as valid and as limitless a medium as any other kind of film.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've been way over an hour, but I still am so happy you're able to do this and share this story with everyone. So thank you so much, Peter, for doing this. I really appreciate it.
It's a real pleasure.